Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Coming up after the news, it's Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today, the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein.
One of the 20th century's most influential, controversial, and quotable philosophers.
Whereon one cannot speak, thereon one must be silent.
Philosophical problems arise from language gone on holiday.
The world is the totality of facts, not of things.
The limits of my language are the limits of the world.
To understand the history of modern philosophy, one needs to understand Wittgenstein's influence, the Tractatus on the Logical Positivists, and his second book, The Philosophical Investigations on Ordinary Language Philosophy.
So, Wittgenstein was neither a positivist nor an ordinary language philosopher himself.
To learn more about Wittgenstein, his impact on modern thinking, and why it's so important in the 21st century, we'll be joined by Juliet Floyd from Boston University.
When Philosophy Talk continues after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the lovely Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air and via our blog to the internet, our blog, Philosophy Talk the blog, where I've already weighed in on our topic today. The topic is Wittgenstein, one of the great philosophies of the 20th century. Now, John, I know you were raised at Cornell by a bunch of Wittgensteinians. Isn't that right? Well,
oh, yes, yes. When I was at Cornell, the two of Wittgenstein's students, Max Black and Norman Malcolm, were the big guns there. It was a very Wittgensteinian place.
So you imbibed a lot of Wittgenstein. What do you think about Wittgenstein?
Well, I divide Wittgenstein's philosophy and his influence into the good, the not so good, and the ugly.
I kind of like that. The good, the not so good, and the ugly. Tell me about the good. What do you think? What's the good?
Well, I like a lot of his first book, The Tractatus. Starts with the observation that the world is a totality of facts, not of things. I think that's a very deep insight. You can list all the things in the world, Ken Taylor, John Perry, Juliet Floyd, and you won't have the world.
Right,
you need to say what they're like and what they're doing.
Right. Ken Taylor is drinking water or something like that.
Right.
That true words were never spoken. That's good.
Simple idea, but one that I think has profound consequences. And later, and I tend to like his philosophy of language. I don't think he gave up a lot of the tenets of the Tractatus in the Investigations. I think he deepened them with this concept of a language game, the idea that to understand a word like slab, for instance, it's not enough to know that it stands for a certain kind of building block. You have to see how it works in the give and take of life as expressed in language. And to do that, you strip down a language game to its essentials. I think that's a great idea.
Right.
I try to use it in my work.
Well, language as action. I mean, that's the thing, right? Language is concrete doing. I mean, and it's the use of language to do things and accomplish things that really matters. Okay, that's some of the good. What about the not so good, as far as you're concerned?
Wittgenstein's philosophy of mind, I think, is a mixture of insight and shortcoming. He had this idea that he wouldn't have called behavioristic, but it became sort of behavioristic as it developed, and I think it was supplanted by better work by people like Lewis and Fodor and Putnam, over took some of his ideas and developed them in a more interesting way.
I think you're right. I mean, Wittgenstein was one of the great. He initiated the turn away from inner life. You know, there's not this stuff in us. It's all out there. And you're right, it leads to behaviorism. I think that's ugly, but you say that's the not so good. What do you think is the really ugly stuff in Wittgenstein?
Well, I think his idea that philosophers don't build theories was pretty bad. The only philosopher I remember saying anything kind about is Frege. He you know, kind of manipulated Russell and Moore. And then there was this kind of cult of personality that built up around him. When I was an undergraduate, I read Malcolm's memoir, and I thought, oh, Wittgenstein, he's great. He's one of these philosophical heroes, kind of like Clint Eastwood. He cuts through everything and takes us to deeper depths. But by the time I was writing my dissertation, I thought, what a jerk.
Well, well, you might. To learn more about Wittgenstein, the person, our roving philosophical reporter Zoe Corneli files this report.
Ludwig Wittgenstein was a genius, and like a lot of geniuses, he was also really weird.
Calling him an eccentric is, in a way, far too mild for what Wittgenstein was, but also doesn't quite capture his genius.
David Edmonds is co-author with John Idenow of the book Wittgenstein's Poker.
One can't understand the bewitchment of Wittgenstein's philosophy and his reputation without also recognizing that there was something extraordinary about his personality and the sheer power of his presence. He was relatively short. He's 5'6". He's got dark hair. He's got piercing blue eyes. He's a bundle of nervous energy. He's extremely charismatic. He has a great deal of presence. He walks fast. He talks fast. He is intolerant, capable of great intolerance, so that many people tiptoed around him, because if they said something stupid, he could pounce on them. And some of them found it very difficult to recover from Wittgenstein's, what some would say, bullying approach.
Edmund's book is subtitled The Story of a 10-Minute Argument Between Two Great Philosophers.
It was a cold night in Cambridge, England, on October 25th, 1946, and Karl Popper, the Viennese-born philosopher, was newly arrived in England from New Zealand, where he'd spent the war years, and he was invited up to the Cambridge Moral Science Club, which is the philosophy society at Cambridge University, and he was asked to deliver a paper, and he was asked to bring up a philosophical puzzle. Popper decided to lecture on the subject, are there philosophical problems?
During the talk, Wittgenstein, the club's president, started interrupting, demanding an example of a philosophical problem. Nothing Popper came up with could satisfy him.
And eventually, Wittgenstein was getting so agitated that he bent down and he picked up the fireside poker, and he was gesticulating with it wildly. And he demanded of Popper an example of a moral principle, whereupon Popper said, "Thou should not threaten a visiting lecturer with a poker."
Wittgenstein wrote his first book, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, in the trenches during World War I.
And once he's published the Tractatus, he believes he's solved all the problems of philosophy. And as he solved all the problems of philosophy, there's not much point doing any more philosophy.
Wittgenstein spent time working as a gardener, a primary school teacher, and an architect.
And eventually, he decides that actually he hasn't solved all the problems of philosophy, and it's time to go back to the discipline.
Wittgenstein spent the rest of his life writing, but didn't finish anything.
If you go to a library now, or if you go to a bookshop now, you will see whole shelves of books written by Wittgenstein. He scribbled all through his life, and these books have been assembled posthumously.
Wittgenstein died in 1951. His most famous work, Philosophical Investigations, was published 2 years later. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
Thanks, Zoe, for that report. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk. With me is Ken Taylor.
And, John, you're a much nicer guy than Wittgenstein. I got to say that. We're joined today by Juliet Floyd. She's professor of philosophy at Boston University, co-editor of Future Past, the Analytic Tradition in 20th Century Philosophy. Juliet, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, John and Ken.
Hi, Juliet. John Perry here. Julia, people often talk about the linguistic turn in 20th century philosophy. Tell us what it was, and what did our man Wittgenstein have to do with it?
Right. Well, I think it has to do with, in Wittgenstein's case, the problem of the nature of logic coming to the center of his attention as soon as he read Frege and Russell as a young man. Russell's system, as you know, in Principia Mathematica, was in part devoted to solving the paradoxes that had emerged when Frege tried to make logic a maximally universal, internally consistent, perfectly explicit science, and to drive all of arithmetic from it. And Wittgenstein was very taken with the idea that when one tries to formulate the laws of logic fully explicitly, one generates a contradiction. So he begins exploring the limits of sense from inside and more or less tries his whole life, I think, to see how to make sense of logic with a small l.
So
So
logic
let me,
within
let me just remind
living,
our listeners
language
yeah, about
of a community
about Frege and Russell. Frege was end of the 19th century, early 20th century logician and philosopher, and Russell was famous for being Bertrand Russell, the anti-war person. But between the two of them, and with help from others, they really revolutionized the field of logic and prepared it as one of the great influences on the development of computer science. So we see Wittgenstein as kind of the philosopher influenced by this really momentous development in logic. So sorry for interrupting, Julia. Continue.
But let's set the stage here. So logic struck these folks at the beginning, toward the end of the 19th century and at the beginning of the 20th century, because of Frege's innovations as like this great clarifying thing, right? I mean, it was this great, utterly clarifying thing. Kant had said way back when that logic hadn't advanced since Aristotle, right? But at the beginning of the 20th century, toward the end of the 19th century, there were huge advances in logic. Is that right, Julia?
That's right, Ken. Frege, in fact, explodes the complexity of the subject. And John's exactly right. Frege wrote down the first formalized language. And although Frege didn't think of it this way, we might say it was really the first programming language ever written down. But Frege retained in his philosophy of logic a very Kantian, Enlightenment, traditional, universalist view that logic formulates a universal framework within which all human discourse, insofar as it concerns truth, takes place. So that big a-contextual picture of logic is now reinforced with a very sophisticated mathematical tool. And it's to Wittgenstein's great credit that he saw right away as a young man that this would revolutionize philosophy, because philosophers would try to use this mathematics as an organon for theories of mind and language and meaning.
So, but you mentioned logic with a small L, and what I get from that is these guys, Russell and Frege, at least the early Russell, really had kind of this Platonic or view of logic as they're disclosing to us these truths of some ideal world. The mathematician's paradise, Russell called it. But Wittgenstein, at least by the time he wrote the Investigations, really pulled that out of the clouds and saw logic, I guess, is just part of language, a very human institution. Logic with a small L, I think that's what you mean, right? Logic as grounded in language, not grounded in some abstract heaven of Platonic ideas.
Yes, and I would say even in the early philosophy, the reaction against Frege and Russell is very important in Wittgenstein, where they had made logic the maximally general science whose laws concerned all objects and all concepts and would govern all discourse in any other science. Wittgenstein responds in his early work with the other extreme, saying logic is empty. What makes logic logic is it has no factual content. There is no such thing as a logical object. There is no such thing as a logical law. What we have are very complicated patterns, grammatical structures that are fundamental to any natural languages. But there is no general law of logic that itself is true or false.
Right, but that's because
logic emerges through what we say that is true and false in particular cases.
That's because Wittgenstein, tell me if I've got this right. That's because, I understand it, that's because Wittgenstein thought that logic was basically something like the frame or the scaffolding that was not part of the picture, right? And so you couldn't state logical truths within the frame and the scaffolding. You can state things that have sense, right? That can be made true or false by the world somehow. But the frame or scaffolding that makes those statements possible, logic is at that level. So you can't really assert logic. Is that right? Is that
precisely
the right way to think about it?
Precisely. Logic needs to be treated in a different way, as you say, at a different level. If you and I are able to disagree over the facts, that's because already we subscribe to some willingness to acknowledge certain patterns of argumentation and reasoning as relevant. And there's no holding those up and asking whether they correspond to the facts, if in fact these laws, as you say, are the scaffolding against which the whole practice of talking about truth and falsity takes place.
So, Juliet, we'll come back to this in just a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is Ludwig Wittgenstein. Our guest is Juliet Floyd from Boston University.
We've been talking about Wittgenstein's life and his role in 20th century philosophy. Next, his main ideas about language and how they changed or didn't change between his two most important works, the Tractatus and his later philosophical investigations. You can join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917.
Is logic the scaffolding of the world or part of the world? We'll take your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Steve Reich and Explanations Come to an End Somewhere, music based on the writings of Ludwig Wittgenstein, I'm told. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. I wasn't too impressed with that music based on Wittgenstein, but hey, there you go. Our topic is Wittgenstein. Tell us your thoughts about analytic philosophy, the linguistic turn. If you know about Wittgenstein's role in it, share, weigh in, good, bad, or indifferent thing, the linguistic turn in philosophy. Whatever your view, let's hear it.
The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Juliet Floyd from Boston University. Juliet, I want to go back to what we were talking about at the end about and a little bit about how Wittgenstein's view changes from the Tractatus to the investigations, because you were saying, and I think you're right, that logic for Wittgenstein is this scaffolding, right? And what he's trying to do is kind of articulate the limits of the thinkable and the sayable, and logic is at the sort of end, and you can't really say what logic is because you can't say what the frame is like, right? He's got this distinction between saying and showing, for example. But he changes his mind, at least some people think, radically, about this whole thing as he moves to the investigation. Do you think that's right, that he changes his mind radically?
I think he does evolve. I think he comes to think that the Tractatus was far too simplistic and far too general and far too hopeful about having gotten to the basic fundamental root of where people go wrong in thinking, both about logic and about ethics. I should add, I think ethics in the Tractatus is very important to Wittgenstein. As another place where we tend to look for universal a priori laws and get worried if we can't find them or figure out how to ground them. But I think a lot of the ideas in the Tractatus about exploring the limits of sense from the inside remain. It's just that Wittgenstein came to believe he'd been far too simple-minded. First of all, he had relied on only part of logic in order to try to make sense of the whole. And later on, he met mathematicians like Ramsey, he talked with Russell Moore, he read Hilbert, he read Gödel, and he came to realize he was just out of date as far yeah. as modern mathematical logic went. So the structures and the patterns are much more complicated than he had thought.
Juliet,
the underlying philosophical urge, as he himself said, came to him very early, and I think that parallel between logic and ethics remains with him and affects
that.
The later work
let's explore
very
this,
clearly.
This ethical dimension of the Tractatus a little bit. Wittgenstein at one point said, I don't know why we are here, but I'm pretty sure it's not in order to enjoy ourselves. But apart from that, I don't know much about his ethics after having read the Tractatus many times. I mean, what is the ethical view, and what in the world does it have to do with logic?
Well, the parallel would be that in ethics, traditionally in modern philosophy, coming through Kant, ethics is viewed, like logic, as a domain in which we try to find universal a priori principles. And Wittgenstein read Schopenhauer in his youth and was very much affected by that Kantian view. But my view is that his attack in the Tractatus on ethics is just like his attack on Frege's picture of logic or Russell's. It's attacking ethics with a big E. So just as logic, though in some sense real or shown in our discourse with one another, logic is empty of factual content, so too is ethics.
Let me ask
and
that.
This is a very fundamental philosophical idea.
Juliet, let me ask you another kind of question related to this. And there's a kind of methodological lesson that comes out of this way of thinking about it that's a little troubling for a philosopher. If philosophy is trying to articulate these framework kind of things, right, that are not, that are in some sense nonsensical, they're not like the empirical claims that take place within the frame, but we're trying to articulate these things that kind of define the frame itself. And if those don't have any content, well, then philosophical claims must be kind of, well, what? Devoid of sense in a way. So
that's
why do we do that? Why do we do that? I mean, what's the...
Well, I think here is the change between the early and the later Wittgenstein. In the early Wittgenstein, he's really emphasizing that philosophy should not be in the business of trying to uncover universal a priori metaphysical orders of things. But he leaves it at that. Whereas in the later philosophy, he gets much more interested in the situated character of our talk in ethics and in logic. And he begins to realize how complicated it is to think through the patterns and structures that affect our uses of language when we reason with one another in the empirical world. So, again, there's continuity here in the overarching aim, but he certainly comes to respect much more how important it is when we're thinking about ethics to look at the details of things.
Join this conversation, 1-800-525-9917. We're doing something that we do sometimes from time to time. We're looking at one of the philosophical greats, and Wittgenstein, whatever you say, pro or con, was certainly one of the greats. He was influential and highly quotable and one of the founding fathers of 20th century analytic philosophy. And Andrew in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Andrew.
Hi. Analytic philosophers seem to overlook something in Wittgenstein when he talks about, they tend to ignore when he talks about things like the mystical, or he says things like, when all the questions of science are answered, the questions of life are unanswered. And it's almost like he's trying to unravel language, not to reach some conclusion or to reach some technological breakthrough or something, but to leave some kind of open spiritual space in his mind, as if it's a transcendental quest. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Julia, what do you think about Andrew's comment?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question. We're offline in Boston, Ken. I have to turn it back to you.
Oh, well, Andrew asked, he said, analytic philosophers tend to ignore kind of the mystical elements.
The transcendental elements
in Wittgenstein, because this stuff that goes beyond the sayable, right? He doesn't dismiss it, but it's a different category, and analytic philosophers haven't really come to grips with that. What do you think?
Well, I think it's true that in the initial scholarship on Wittgenstein, there was much more interest in his writings on logic. But I think there's an increasing interest in thinking about his ethics. What does he mean when he talks about the transcendental? I would regard that as an attack on Kant's view of the transcendental as given through general laws. But it doesn't mean that Wittgenstein wasn't interested in, as we say, drawing the limits of sense from the inside and calling our attention to conditions we've taken for granted in our discourse with one another.
Yeah.
So I would hope that readers of Wittgenstein would continue to be interested in this part of his thought. He was not a mystic, however. The idea that the mystical is a separate realm of discussion in which we talk about non-facts is itself, for Wittgenstein, a very tempting, misleading, and I would say intellectually bad move.
That means the category of the...
And I would read the Tractatus that way as
the
well.
The category of the not sayable but showable, right? That's stuff that can only be shown. And then he ends the Tractatus, that of where we cannot speak, pass over in silence, something like that, right?
Yeah.
You want to say that's not the category of the incomprehensible or the non-cognizable or something like that, like the mystical might be. But what is that category of the showable but not sayable?
It's not a category. I think the problem is when one thinks one can draw a straight line on a piece of paper and write on the left side the realm of the sayable and the sensical, and on the right side, the realm of the nonsensical. There's no such thing as the nonsensical. There are efforts to try to ask philosophical questions and answer them. But when we try to talk at this level of generality, that's when we really fall outside the boundaries of that which is subject to reason.
Okay, let me interrupt you. We've got an email that's right on the topic of things that analytical philosophers haven't appreciated about Wittgenstein. I'll read the email, then I'll give my own answer, and then we'll see what everybody else has to think. This is Alex, and he says, I think you're overlooking how important it was to Wittgenstein to destroy philosophy. One question I've always wanted to ask those who really, as philosophers, engage with Wittgenstein as a philosopher is to what extent one can really do philosophy with Wittgenstein without, in some sense, rejecting or discounting his most fundamental idea, which seems to me that there really isn't such a thing as philosophy at all. So here's my reaction. When I got to UCLA in 1968, I just spent 4 years at Cornell, and I had just kind of read the Tractatus and the Investigations a couple hundred times each, and I thought, well, one thing I can do is be a Wittgenstein expert. So I started out that way, but then much to my dismay, it turned out that there weren't just these two books, this kind of fixed small corpus that a lazy person like myself can deal with. But book after book came out. This man did philosophy his entire life, writing and writing and writing. So I think this was just bad faith, this idea that philosophy is over, and I'm all for ignoring it. What do you think, Juliet?
I ignore it, too. I think it sounds much too much like a drive-by quotation from Richard Rorty. Wittgenstein himself said that when he wrote philosophy should be able to bring itself peace, that was a lie because he could never leave it alone. Right. So when we read the investigations, we're reading the culmination, as you say, of many, many years of writing. And what he kept doing when he was drafting that work was to cut and cut and cut the detailed discussions of Dedekind, Frege, Schopenhauer, and Kant out of the manuscript. He was trying to write, in spite of himself, perhaps, a classic that would last.
But Juliet,
that's why the book reads the way it does.
I understand what you're saying, but Juliet and John, I do think there's something utterly serious in Wittgenstein, both in the Tractatus, but also, and more so even, in the investigation. There is a deep belief that philosophy is some kind of malady, not philosophizing, but the deliverances of philosophy heretofore are the result of some kind of malady. And that Wittgenstein has the cure for that malady in a new kind of philosophizing, and that old kind of philosophizing should just come to an end. I mean, I think he's utterly serious about that. Don't you agree?
I think he is. Yes, in a sense. Philosophers nowadays don't tend to write about reason with a capital R in the same kind of way. That's not just because of Wittgenstein, but I would say one of Wittgenstein's great legacies to 20th century philosophy is getting philosophers not to do that. Talking about reason or talking about value as such are very complicated matters. So he does think there's been a kink in the history of philosophy. I don't think he thinks he made it. I think he's trying to philosophize in the face of that kink. And if I may say so, I think the 20th century intellectual history bears him out.
Well, I kind of agree with that. And I'd like to kind of set the stage for maybe some of our listeners who aren't steeped in 20th century philosophy. If you go back to the Cambridge of Wittgenstein's day and Russell's day, there was this fellow named MacTaggart, a brilliant fellow, wrote 3 volumes on the nature of existence. And he had an argument that's really perplexed people over the years about the unreality of time. And he put out this argument, and the conclusion was time is unreal. And I think that's a kind of a good example of what Wittgenstein might regard as pretentious philosophy. I mean, it's fine to put out this puzzle about time, but to suppose that a philosopher, by kind of thinking about time, is going to come up with the conclusion that time is unreal is kind of just to divorce the whole enterprise from understanding how language actually works and how we talk about time. And we live, all of us, even Ken, who thinks Wittgenstein was mostly pernicious, we live in a post-Wittgensteinian era where that's our natural approach to these things.
I agree about that in a way. I agree about that we do live in a post-Wittgensteinian era, and I wouldn't try to recover the pre-Wittgensteinian bad old days. And there's certain insight. I mean, Wittgenstein makes this claim that philosophical problems, and I think he's thinking of old philosophical problems, the, quote, enduring problems of philosophy arise from, quote, language gone on a holiday. Right? This goes back to John's notion of a language game that we talked about earlier. You know, if you just look at the language game in which certain kind of philosophically supposedly problematic terms are at home and the forms of life those that sustain those language games, you know, terms like free or no or self or other, you'll find that these philosophical problems are generated by people just not paying attention to these language games and the forms of life. And he says to philosophers, don't theorize, just look. Just look at what we already do. That makes philosophy a very homely thing.
A homely thing, Ken, but I would also say, unlike J.L. Austin, who was an ordinary language philosopher, whom I admire, actually, I think Austin was very important, too, Wittgenstein is writing, in his way, a great defense of the eternal problems as well. It's very open-ended. One can look within the context of a particular language game and get a lot of illumination. But it certainly is part of the picture of language we see in the philosophical investigations, that language will not carry us into every possible context that we can think up for it a priori. And that language is not to be expected to take us into any possible empirical situation we hadn't foreseen. So language will have to evolve. And when we shift, those philosophical questions will be back with us.
Right. We'll take that up some more soon. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Wittgenstein with Juliet Floyd from Boston University.
We've been talking about Wittgenstein's great works, the Tractatus and the Philosophical Investigations. Next, we'll consider his legacy. What of lasting value has come from the work of Wittgenstein?
The legacy of Wittgenstein, for good or for ill. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
And words are all I have to take your heart away.
That's the Bee Gees and words. A lot of people don't realize the Bee Gees had this earlier philosophical period, Ken. I think they had an album called Tractatus Disco Philosophicus.
Right.
I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. I was wondering if that was from their Tractarian period or their investigations period. We're tackling the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein, the wit and wisdom of Wittgenstein. And we'd like you to hear from you. We're having some technical difficulties. If you want to join this conversation, email us, comments@philosophytalk.org. We'd love to have you join in.
Email us, comments@philosophytalk.org, just to repeat that. And
I think you've got an email there now.
Yeah, I do have an email here. Let's go to this. Julia, I'm going to give you a hard assignment here. Paul writes, could the guest please explain Wittgenstein's private language argument? So I'll give you a minute to discuss this important landmark in the history of thought.
And 1 minute, Juliet.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, Wittgenstein was very interested, as I say, in logic and ethics. And I read the private language considerations as circling around an idea very old in his thought, that somehow solipsism, the idea that I'm the only mind and everything else is a figment of my mind, solipsism and realism really come to the same thing in the end. If you really think through the realist metaphysician, who wants to say that's all that's real is what's objective and mind independent, in the end these positions collapse into one another. And the private language considerations in the later philosophy are circling around this kind of problem. Wittgenstein asks whether I could imagine coining a language for myself which would be incomprehensible in principle to anyone else. And the suggestion is that if I tried to do that and thought it through, I might well become incomprehensible to myself. So this is how I see the private language argument. I do not see it as advocating behaviorism, by the way.
Do you think that President Bush has more or less invalidated the private language argument?
I think there are growing forms of irrationality in the world, John, that require treatment. And I must say, I think Wittgenstein's philosophy is very relevant today.
We're trying
to reconcile ourselves to the failure of certain ideals of logic to make themselves felt in the world.
You said that the private language argument doesn't give rise to behaviorism, and I think you're right about that. And I think a widely shared, sometimes misinterpretation of Wittgenstein was that he was a behaviorist. But it does do something in common with a behaviorist. It does say that mindedness is somehow out there, right? It's not internal. There aren't these private exhibits that come before my mind, which are my meanings, my thoughts, my sensation. And you know, the Cartesian thing, well, the first object of my knowledge and awareness are my own mental states, my own sensations, and it's a problem about how to get out there. Wittgenstein somehow thinks that if we just pay attention to how the talk about mind, the language of mindedness works, we'll see that minds are already out there. They're already public in some sense.
I think it's the interplay between my situation in inheriting language as an individual and the social context that Wittgenstein thinks is a dynamic interplay, Ken. It's not that he's a social constructivist who thinks that what's true is simply what 30,000 Americans say is true. He certainly thinks that they can be wrong. So it's the idea that you can't locate meaning in one place or in one kind of account, be it a psychological account or a sociological account. That's where Wittgenstein, I think, is pushing with this argument.
I want to explore a little bit what you mean by that. I mean, okay, look, let's make some distinctions. For those in our audience, behaviorism is the view that, well, mind talk just somehow reduces to talk about publicly observable behavior. And that's all there is, right? There's no, like, inner stuff. We're not talking about inner stuff. It just kind of analytically reduces, or if we want to make scientific progress, all we should care about is the outer stuff and don't posit these mysterious inner causes. Okay, Wittgenstein wasn't a behaviorist like that. But there is this kind of what I call the disappearance of the inner. I'm trying to make sense of, that's one of the things that really boggles me about that whole period in philosophy, right? There is inner life. There are inner thoughts. There are inner feelings. It's not all just out there.
Let me just interject here for a second. I really think that we can learn something here from Wittgenstein's very simple language game of the slab, block, slab, and so forth. Because we might think that those are just paradigm cases of naming. And in the Tractatus, you have a name slab, it stands for a certain kind of block. But in his little exploration, he says, you know, would that make any sense if these weren't part of a form of life, like the very simplest you can imagine, in which a builder says to an assistant, slab, and the slab goes and gets the slabs and brings it to him. It's that integration into what he calls a language game, and that into a form of life, something that goes way beyond language, that gives language its meaning. And I think fundamentally that's the point he's making about sensations, not that they're not real, but that this idea that you can set up a language just by giving names for your sensations is bizarre for basically the same reasons.
That seems like a deep point. Do you agree about John's interpretation of that stuff?
I do. If I scream out in pain and you are worried about whether my word names something, you're sort of missing what's right before your eyes, you might say. And this is a part of the ethical point, again, of Wittgenstein. So things are out there in contexts that we build. It doesn't mean we don't have inner lives. He says explicitly, one human being can be an enigma to another. Right. And we may find our language diverging in particular cases.
But how do we think about
the human condition?
How do we think about the relationship between inner and outer if we're Wittgenstein? How do we think about that? I mean, I take it you'd say Wittgenstein doesn't want to think about it in a behaviorist way, which just says the idea of this inner, mysterious inner is just an illusion or something. Well, I mean, how do you think about the inner?
Put another way, Julia, what's your take on his concept of a criterion?
Oh, well, the criterion is something that is very localized also. It's not a sort of logical set of necessary and sufficient conditions for something to count, for example, as a chair. Nor do I think Wittgenstein should be read as simply arguing always against that picture of meaning. No, fundamentally, it's the idea that if there is to be such a notion as truth, and speaking truth, be it truth about my inner life or truth about the facts before us, if there is to be such an idea, it has to be parochial, fundamentally. It has to be localized and tied by us to circumstances we can make relevant, ultimately, to our lives.
That's complicated. You said a lot of complicated. The trip from my worries about inner lives to John's about criterion to your statement, that's because Wittgenstein, there can't be an inner thing without an outer criterion.
Right.
Right. Now, and you're saying these outer criteria kind of localize particular. Now, does that make, that sounds very pomo relativist. Is Wittgenstein, the last thought I'm going to give you, is Wittgenstein
not.
A pomo relativist?
Not.
How does he differ from a pomo relativist?
Because
briefly.
He's trying to make sense of the notion of truth. He's indebted enough to Frege that he's really interested in how our norms of truth actually apply in the real world. So he's not saying that there's no such thing as truth. He's not saying that truth is, quote, relativized to a language game, or that true for me is not true for you. But he is suggesting that in order to understand how the notion of truth really gets a grip, you do actually have to look at how you operate with that word and think about how what you do interacts with your picture of what truth is.
And if somebody else operates differently with the same word?
Well, he had an analogy in one of his manuscripts. He said, we say that a human behavior flows from character. And it's in that way that use flows from meaning. Now, what I take that to be is something like this. A good person, a person of good character, can act badly. And a person of bad character can act well on occasion.
So, Juliet, I'm going to have to, on that, I'm going to have to let that be the last word. I'm going to have to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Juliet Floyd, professor of philosophy from Boston University, co-editor of Future Past, The Analytic Tradition in 20th Century Philosophy.
We want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to for technical as well as time reasons this time, and a couple of emails came in that we didn't get a chance to read, but thanks for sending them.
Yeah, technical difficulties cut out most of the callers today. So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, it's hard on the radio to get Wittgenstein's most basic lesson, whereof one cannot speak thereon, one must be silent, but we are not allowed to be silent on the radio. We have to keep speaking, even whereof we have not the foggiest idea.
Oh, you know a lot about you were reared on this stuff.
Yeah, I like Wittgenstein. I consider myself a Wittgensteinian, except I don't say that because there's so much has collected around that term that I don't really like.
I think that you're a Wittgensteinian in this thing about the focus of action on language. Mm-hmm. But hey, I think of you as a highly theoretical, systematic philosopher, which Wittgenstein would say, don't do. I mean, so you're not really a deep Wittgenstein.
Well, he said don't do it, but he certainly did. Yeah. Right. I mean, he's got lots of technical term criteria and language games, forms of life, so forth and so on. So, you know, but you know my view about hypocrisy. It's really the engine of human progress.
You know, I actually do believe that Juliet said that we live in a post-Wittgensteinian world. But for good or ill, I mean, whether you agree with Wittgenstein ultimately or not, I do agree. There's no going back beyond Wittgenstein. But the way forward, I think, is really anti-Wittgensteinian. But, you know, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And I've already weighed in, so go check it out, folks.
Yeah, I should do that, too. But not being an insomniac like you, I find it a little more difficult to be a good blogger. You can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. And, you know, get out your popcorn, uncork your Diet Cokes, because coming up now is Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movies.
You know, John, the other day I saw a great flick with lots of philosophical content in it. The Children of Men. Have you seen that flick?
Yes, I have. Clive Owen, Julianne Moore, great acting, interesting story. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, and it poses a really, I think, deep, hard question. Think about the meaning of life. Think about what your life means to you. And now suppose that you knew that in some period there were going to be no more human beings. You know, the last human being was already born and there weren't going to be any more of them. How would that affect your conception of your own life? Here's one of the opening scenes of the movie. Newsflash! The youngest person in the world has died. And Theo, the main protagonist, we see him just utterly depressed by this news. He goes to his office. Everybody's watching it. There's been worldwide infertility for 18 years. No child's been born for 18 years. That means there are no more elementary school students, right? The last high school student is about to have graduated from high school, and there's no one coming behind them. How would that affect life?
Probably the last philosophy PhD student is an undergraduate at that time.
Yeah, that's right.
So we'd be sitting there looking at this pipeline of people to work with and go out and teach younger generations. Maybe nobody would even be writing a philosophy PhD. I don't suppose the world in general would care much about that, but it would get to be to know that this whole process was coming to an end.
And that's kind of the question this movie puts, but let's talk about the way it answers this question, because it's really, really powerful. I mean, the world has gone to hell in a handbasket over this. I mean, societies have collapsed. Everybody is depressed. Every scene in the movie is drab and bleak and dark, right? And people spend a lot of time numbing themselves, right? I mean, the government even dispenses a suicide drug. So if you want to end it now and not go on with this misery, buy it and take it, you know?
Well, let me look at this from the perspective of a somewhat older person. You think people would get so depressed if all of a sudden everybody started kicking off at 67 and we just didn't have this older generation of 67 to 100 hanging around to dispense wisdom and drool?
I think our lives, the meanings of our lives are partly constituted by our tie to the past, but older people represent the past. And humanity wants this renewal. Plato talks about in the Symposium that what we can't be immortal, but what we're after is reproduction through love, and we want to reproduce ourselves. It is our way of being immortal. That's a deep urge of ours. And if there are going to be no generations after us, we're stuck with our own mortality in an inescapable way. And the message of the movie Children of Men is that is deeply, utterly depressing.
You know, we talk about how our presidents, like Clinton and Bush, worry about how history will treat them. Now think about what that means. That means after they're dead, there will be this name that appears in various books in the middle of various sentences written by people that never knew them and they'll never know, read by people that never knew them and they'll never know. And they care a lot about what those sentences surrounding their names are going to be. You ask yourself, why do we build so much of the meaning for our present life out of these future events that we'll never be part of?
But the story, the movie isn't just about that, John. There's a surprise event that happens. I think we have to give that away.
Turns out that a young African lady, who I assume, although I didn't understand everything that happened in the picture, is an illegal immigrant to England, is actually pregnant. Her name is Key, and she's played very well by Claire Hope Ashaty. And so there is some hope that the world will be repopulated, and that's where a lot of the drama comes. What happens to this woman? Is she going to be exploited by the rebels or exploited by the government or snuck out of the country by one of our heroes to some ship that for some reason that remains obscure to me is a better place to be?
Yeah, well, there's this thing called the Human Project. Right, and they want to get her to the Human Project. The Human Project are trying to refertilize people. They're trying to save humanity, supposedly. But nobody knows whether they really exist. I mean, this movie is overwhelmingly despair, depressive, except for this little ray of hope, which emerges out of darkness and in turmoil, and you don't know that it's going to do anything to save the world, anything. But there's little tiny bit of hope that represents the continuing spark of humanity.
Yeah, but still, it seems to me we might be better off if we didn't build the meaning of our lives so much in terms of the past and the future. If we thought more about, look, what can we do for this individual that's right with us, this fellow that's on the street begging, or this child that needs someone to read to them in the local school, or in children that we can help with money, than thinking so much about future generations. I mean, if our beloved president was more worried about what he could do for the kids in America now than what he can do to bring democracy with a capital D to the Middle East with a capital M and a capital E, wouldn't we be all better off?
Well, I don't know. You mean, so you're thinking we shouldn't have the meaning of our lives tied up with the future, with the future generations. I mean, if there weren't future generations, a lot of the stuff that we do couldn't be sustained. A lot of the stuff that gives our lives meaning could not go on.
I guess if you're Clinton or Bush, no matter how kind history is to you, if there's no one around to read the history books, it won't matter much.
You know, we need to end this, and we can end this with a quote from the movie, because there's all kinds of graffiti strewn all over the place. And one lovely piece of graffiti that just flashes for a moment on the screen is, "Last one to die, please turn out the lights."
We've been discussing Children of Men, a very interesting, fascinating, philosophically rich movie, still available at some local theaters, and I'm sure out on DVD before too long. Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in our own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.